I spend a lot of time sitting with dying people, being with them as they die. It's a pastime. It's also something that is incredibly graceful. It's probably the moments when I am most alive. Because when you're with somebody that is at the edge of the mystery, all of your deceits seem very hollow. All of your ways of being charming, kindly, helpful, you know, it's all blah. And all you can be is truthful. Now, I've been working with dying for 25, 30 years. People said, well, why don't you train other people? What am I going to do, give a certificate? You now can help people die. Because what I've learned is the only thing I can offer is my truth. I can offer what I am at the moment. And if I'm frightened, if I say I'm frightened, we have at least a shared truth. The predicament for people that are dying is that their symbolic value becomes so powerful for everybody around them that everybody freaks one way or another. Gets intellectual, kind, concerned, something. And it cuts the person off from a real contact because they're busy responding to the symbol. And my art form in working with dying people is to see beyond their symbolic value, but in order to do that, I have to see beyond my own. So if I'm somebody that's come to help the dying, I can see that's certain, he's come, you know that one. I've got to just eat that one alive. And then be with a person like, are you here? I'm here. So what's new? Well, I'm dying. Aha. Uh-huh. Well, I'm living. So. To open to just what is. The art of not getting caught in the melodrama of dying, which is the biggest drama going in town, let me tell you. Your own or anybody else's or the universe's. The Earth's. Let's put the Earth. Let's be humble. The universe will hardly notice. Be present in with death and say, so, yes. It's all part of just the flow and force of the universe. It's just changing patterns of energy. And who you think you are dies and who you are doesn't. It's as simple as that. But you are, as a human, both a combination of who you are and who you think you are. And that's what being human is about. We're all being somebody with each other. And that's in time and space, and it comes and goes. It's like when people identify with their personalities too strongly, which it's very much in vogue to do in this culture. Everybody thinks they're real. And you really have to play along. They get very upset if you don't take them like they're real, you know? And as long as they think they're real, they're suffering. It's just part of the territory. Because they're always using the world to make sure they are who they think they are, you know. Do you see me as who I think I am? All you can do for another person is be an environment in which if they wanted to come up for air, they could. And if they don't, you, my love and blessings to you. You can't do it to other people. People do it to themselves. You can't bloom flowers. You can create fertilizer and keep the soil moist and stuff. Karma unfolds. You can be an environment that doesn't have a trip going, that limits another person from being what they can be. You're my husband. You're the one that puts out the garbage. I know who you are, you know? New day, my dear. How many of us even risk that possibility? See? We create these efficient models. I'll be who you think I am if you'll be who I think you are. Let's not, you know. And I'd appreciate if you would think I am who I think I am. So we go into these little kind of prisons of our mind, which are these models of who we think we are, and then you lead with your model all the time. How do you do? Well, I'm, you know. So the question is, how do you find that part of a person who isn't busy being who they think they are? And that's by finding the place in yourself, which is not place, of course, where there's no definition, there's no place to stand. Where we are one and we are many. And I'm a Jew and I'm not a Jew, and I'm a man and I'm not a man, and I'm Anglo and I'm not Anglo, and I'm... Because the minute I identify with any definition of myself or any desire system, I immediately need you to reassure me about it. We have to play a game, a conspiracy game together. The fact is, there's no definition of any of us. We play parts. We play thousands of parts all the time. They are part of our incarnation. They're beautiful. We honor them. We love them. I am my father's son. I am an American. I am a Jew. I am, you know, a New Age hippie. I am a thousand things. I am a servant of God. I am God. I am empty. I am full. I am sad, yes. As I look with my human eyes, my heart breaks. I am joyful, yes, because I see the dance, the play of it all. I see the perfection of birth and the perfection of death. I see the way in which suffering is growth. I don't ever say to somebody that's suffering, it's good for you. I do my best to relieve their suffering. Isn't that a paradox? Even though for me, my suffering has been my grace. But you don't do another person's trip. You just create an environment where they do what they need to do. My joy with my father came when I didn't have to convert him. I didn't have to wake him up for his own best interests, like he'd been trying to do to me for years. He kept saying, but what are you going to live on? See, he was trying to wake me up to the reality he lived in. Once he came with his my stepmother, who was not yet married. He was courting my stepmother. I was speaking in New York at the Unitarian Church on Central Park West. I was wearing all white, and I was sitting in front of a huge mural of Jesus washing the feet of the disciples. My father, this Jewish leader, was sitting in the back of this room next to his girlfriend, who isn't Jewish. Intermarriage, very tricky. I approved, though. It was okay. And he leans over to her. He says, I feel like the Virgin Mary. It's interesting to stop locking everything in so much by being so attached to your thoughts. To extricate yourself back into your awareness so you can watch the play of thought, the delight of definitions, of movement, of models, of reality. We're all going to die. Look, it's a miracle. You can go into any one of those spaces, and they're all true. See, people think that to be happy, they mustn't be sad. And the far-out thing is that true happiness comes when you embrace all of it, so you don't look away in order to be happy. If you're hot, it's just called suffering. Now suffer, but, you know, enjoy it. Allow it. Acknowledge it. Like, I'm sweating. Isn't that interesting? Not, oh my God, I'm sweating. But, sweating-ness. Am I sweating? Yeah, I'm sweating. Are you completely sweating? No, of course not. There is sweating happening. It's not my sweating, it's just sweating. I can make it into yours if you want it, but otherwise it's just general sweating that's happening. must say there are ways to live life that are so light and so playful in the midst of it all hitting the fan fully, in the midst of the conflagration, in all of it, and you're still doing everything you can to heal, to help, to make it all beautiful, and yet you're at peace. Isn't that interesting? Most people think that to do something, they got to be somehow out of balance, frustrated, angry, think something's wrong. But there's a concept in the East called Dharma, where you're just doing your thing because it's the thing you do. And as you open to the fullness of your humanity, you hear, you begin to listen, and you hear what your thing is to do. If you're to be a neurotic, be an essence neurotic. No, if you're to be an achiever, be an achiever. Be a perfect achiever. Be impeccable. Use skillful means. The skillful means that comes from non-attachment. Your downfall is taking yourself so seriously, thinking you're real as a separate entity, when you're only really relatively real. You're not a lie, but you're not the whole truth. It should be reassuring. Really, should be very reassuring to you.
If you and I are going to be instruments of healing of ourselves and the universe, ultimately we must be able to look suffering right in the eye and keep our hearts open. And in order to do that, you continue to cultivate the part of your consciousness that shows it to you from a different perspective. The part that sees it all going back into the one, or the part that sees the perfection of suffering. And for example, my stepmother, she was dying of cancer. And it was very painful. And she was a very tough, strong-willed lady. And we loved each other a lot. And she was being courageous and putting up with it, which in our culture is a good thing, right? Aren't you courageous? She's certainly strong behind this. The pain got so great that at some point she gave up. You know how in our culture you never give up. But she gave up. And at the moment she gave up, we were just so close together at that moment, that the moment she gave up, that is, her ego gave up, it was like a shell was broken and something was born. It wasn't born, it was reborn. It was something very familiar that you sort of sensed was in her, but you never got a chance to see it because her ego was so strong. And suddenly it was there for her and for me. And the last few days of her life, she was just absolutely radiant and in bliss. Imagine she gave up, lost, and then won. And what I saw in there was a being that I had hoped always to see, and I had never been able to quite see. And it was the same for her about herself. She was finding who she was, who she couldn't get to most of the time because her habits of thinking about herself were so strong. Now, when I look at that example, what am I to think about the pain and suffering? From a psychological and physical point of view, it stinks. I don't want Phyllis to suffer. I love her. I don't want her to be in pain. From a spiritual point of view, that was the thing that broke the egg. Is it evil or good? Can I, as a human being, handle the paradox, the seeming paradox, of the fact that it's both perfect and it stinks? And it is actually in the ability to keep those two planes going simultaneously that lies the possibility, therein lies the possibility of being able to have your heart break and break and break and break, because there is another quality of presence behind it in which it's just unfolding and it's all fine.
Like my guru used to say to me, Ram Dass, don't you see it's all perfect? And I'd say, perfect? What about Bangladesh? What about children dying? What, you know? And he'd say, don't you see? Don't you see? Can't you see the plane where it means something different than it means here? And what I learned was that as I started to accept the fact there was a mystery in the universe that I didn't understand. See, we with our human minds and our human empathy judge the whole system. And what we're saying is, hey, God, you really screwed up. If you hadn't screwed up, you wouldn't make children die. You wouldn't do this. You wouldn't do that. Has it ever dawned on us that maybe there's something to it all that we don't understand? And what I've experienced is, through whatever techniques I've used, is a sense of the awe of the way it all is when I get out of my judging separate mind and I have a sense of awe at the mystery of things. It's a quality of compassion that allows the universe to be where it is, looks at the universe and says, there is immeasurable suffering that my heart is always going to keep breaking and breaking and breaking from the suffering. And I still must keep it open. And I will do what I can to relieve the suffering. And I will not burn out for what suffering I cannot relieve. And there's a way to find a space in that whole thing for acting where you don't get lost in your empathy, because there's another part of you that has inherent within it an appreciation of the mystery. And I just tell you, this is work one keeps doing on oneself to find those balances of forms. Because the minute you just get into your emotional heart, it's hell. It's hell. I mean, today, 35,000 women watched their babies die of malnutrition. 35,000. Think of one of them doing that. Think of 35,000. Where are you going to begin to feel the pain of that? Where? And so finally you kind of, oh! And in fact, the whole idea of staying alive in the universe, being living spirit, is the relation you have with suffering. And your ability to embrace the suffering and say, I don't understand it, but okay, and I'll do what I can, and my heart's going to break again and again and again and again, and here I am. And there is a way to be present in the midst of suffering and be peaceful. Because your lack of peace is not relieving anybody's suffering. Finally, you have to do this kind of work on yourself. You have to find a place to stand in the presence of it, because every time you turn it off, you cut off the life force and you cut off your ability to help it. It's a powerful issue. It's a very powerful issue.
For years, for a long, long time, very much afraid to open my heart to individuals, for fear I would hurt too much. And now I find the absolute breathtaking nature of the work with people that are dying is that if you are going to be there for another person, the optimum way is to fall in love. Then you're really there. But imagine falling in love with people that keep dying out from under you. Because when you fall in love, you then become attached to the form and you want the form to stay. And that's where your suffering is, of holding to a form. But I found that as the deeper quality of oneness or presence or awareness exists day by day, minute by minute, as I keep cultivating it, there is a part of me that can sit with somebody who is dying, who I love, who is making my heart break, and there's another part of me that is equanimous, even, and it's delicate to say it, but even giggling. That's how bizarre it is. Even giggling. because you're giggling just as if you were watching the beautiful leaves turn red and fall off the trees at the beauty of the whole process of nature, and you're just giggling. There's a giggle at the dance and the form and the seeming reality of it, and yet at the dreamlike nature of it all, and you're delighted at being part of the universe, and at the same moment it hurts like hell. Now at those moments there is a quality of living truth that becomes very addictive. It's the ability to be passionately involved in life and at the same moment perfectly spacious and equanimous. And if those seem paradoxical, that's because paradox, which exists on one horizontal plane in the mind, means two things are logically inconsistent. Vertical planes of reality, it all is. And your fullness of your humanity and your divinity combined is your ability to have the pain and have the joy at the same moment. We have so many categories in our lives. You say, we're going to go out and have fun. How can you have fun when so-and-so is suffering? And how many times when you go out to, quote, have fun, do you put aside the things that make you sad? I'll tell you, there's something much more interesting than that, which is the fullness of a moment where you don't have to filter out parts of the moment, where you can be in it and somebody says, are you happy? And you say, yeah. Are you sad? Yeah. Is it beautiful? Yeah. Is it horrible? Right. And there is the feeling of the allness, the all and everythingness of the moment. Because at this moment, there are people dying of incredible suffering. There's violence, there's fear. There's also spring coming. There are bloods on the trees. There are beautiful babies cooing. There's dogs jumping. And there's all kinds of things. Butterflying flying. There's, you know. So what should you do? You want to be sad or happy? If you block out any part of it, you've got to block out some of the energy, and then you're not fully alive. You start to use defenses against this. See, Buddha's first noble truth was there is suffering. The second one was the cause of suffering is the clinging of the mind. If there weren't clinging, there wouldn't be so much suffering. That's the third noble truth. If you didn't cling to life, you wouldn't suffer so much about dying. If you didn't cling to, you have a relationship, you want to hold on to the person, you cling. You're going to suffer because it's something's going to give way sooner or later. It's just absolutely inevitable in the law of probability. So you, as you kind of work with these kinds of truths, you begin to see the way and examine the way in which your mind's models of reality and expectations about how it is keep creating suffering for you because they don't jibe with how it is. And you're not open to how it is, you're busy trying to make it how you think it ought to be. Except it isn't that way anymore because everything in form is changing, including you and everybody else. Can you imagine having a thing in your mind which keeps trying to stop change in the middle of a universe in which everything's changing? Don't you see you're doomed to suffer? And the question then is how you can be with change in a way that doesn't suffer. You have models, but they're constantly open to new information. You are fully with what is from moment to moment. As you begin to see that the suffering is showing you where your mind is clinging, and if indeed you want to get free, then suffering is a clue to you of where you're holding, and you begin to use the suffering in order to awaken out of where you're holding. Can you hear that one? So under those conditions, you look at suffering and it's really great. It's helping on your curriculum. And if you get far enough out on that trip, you say, suffering is indeed grace. But now you look at somebody that comes to you that is suffering. They've just lost somebody, or they've hurt their body, or they've got a life-threatening disease, or they're starving, what? And they come up and they're suffering, and what do you say? Suffering is grace? You've got to hear the predicament that for different people, suffering means different things. And it isn't your job to morally impose how the game should be played, but to listen and be there for each person as they need you to be, not to decide you should grow from your suffering. That isn't the contract they entered into with you. So you learn how to work with your own suffering in one way and work with other people's suffering in another way. And sometimes people will say, help me grow and help me by helping me understand my suffering. That's different than if they just come up and say, I'm in pain. It's interesting because from the place that you're seeing the perfection of the unfolding of law, it includes all of it, including your human hearts wanting to take away suffering from other people. That's part of the perfection of it all. So you begin to see these aren't errors in the system we're talking about. This is the beauty of the balance of the system. Human heart that breaks, cosmic heart that stays wide open. Formless form. The balance of the mind and the heart. The intellectual mind is the instrument of your separateness. The heart is the vehicle of your unity. That's a very profound polarity or struggle that we have between our mind and our heart. And what we end up with is a creative tension in which we're trying to preserve our separateness and we're also trying to merge into the unity of all things. And we give each of it its due.
Again and again, I've been with somebody as they approach death, when their will and their ego are struggling like hell to push against it, to control the moment of death, to control something. And then the pain or something becomes too great and they surrender, which is so totally unappealing to us, the concept of surrender. And then you watch and just watching the beauty of the transformation, just the beauty of it, the mystery in which a being moves from one plane of consciousness to another because they are still somebody's dwelling somewhere. Because for conscious being, Ramana Maharshi, great saint, he was dying and it was cancerous arm and he didn't want any medication or anything. He said, no, it's time to let the body go. And all the devotees were crying, don't leave us, don't leave us. And he was confused. He looked and said, don't be silly, where could I go? I mean, I'm just taking off the shirt. I'm not doing it, you know, I'm selling the Ford. I'm not going anywhere. Don't leave us, don't leave us. It's only the Ford, don't get upset. I'll be here. So interesting to work with grieving people, to realize what they're grieving for. Because they're grieving for the particular take they had of that other being whom they loved. They're attached to the form of the being rather than to the essence. But the minute they quiet down from their hysteria, which they have to go through, perfectly, and I push people back in, go grieve some more, you haven't grieved enough. But they come to a point where they quiet down a little bit from the drama of losing a loved one, and then they realize that if they really touched love with another person, where could they go? And then you feel nourished by a person that's left, not impoverished. You're only impoverished at one level. You're nourished at another level because you're no longer caught in separateness. My guru died in 1973, and we've never been closer. Isn't that weird? I mean, to have thought of having him in a body would be lovely. I'd love to rub his feet, but what difference am I? It's only out there. All I know is I touched wisdom. And now the only job is to recognize it, to become it. It's only the same for you. Each of us has the same job here. And wisdom is where there is joy in the presence of suffering, where there is joy in the presence of death, because you understand the laws of karma. You just see the whole way is all unfolding. And you are not only a piece of that which is unfolding, you are the unfolding, and you are the silence that exists behind the unfolding. And if you're going to be fully human, you're going to know all that at least. Not only know it, but be it. What an incredible thing it is for us to be human.
This is the end of Side 7. Side 8 is already queued up for your listening.